retreat. By mentioning, I arrived here with two sets of flowers. The story of this one. The story of this vase, it belonged to a woman while we were beginning our and so brought here in a sense. A baby shower somewhere else later today. So the vase is the vase of someone who's passed away, and the flowers celebrate the arriving of someone else. Baby shower. Those went put together in the same place and then brought here. And the person who brought them said that he was also bringing them partly to celebrate the Vesak, the Buddha's birthday, which we'll celebrate on. And it was very nice to have them here for me. The issue of life and death, of change, Buddhist practice smack down in the middle. Realistically, in the world of change, the world of impermanence, the world of life, birth, and death. And a lot of Buddhist practice is really about coming to some, finding some ease or some peace or some way of being, living realistically in the world of life and death, birth and death. I was struck some years ago by an account of a woman who had done many years of Buddhist practice. Partner. And all her Buddhist friends came to her, a lot of her Buddhist friends came to her and wanted to offer all kinds of practice. And she was feeling all this grief and all this sadness, and it was as if that wasn't okay. But she had to do all these Buddhist things, you know, breathe deeply or whatever, and practice compassion or practice letting go or many of the kind of things you might hear. And she felt it was tremendously disrespectful for her, towards her, that her friends wouldn't just leave her alone with her feelings as they were. And a similar kind of sentiment, but not so strongly, I felt now that I'm a parent. Now that I have become a parent, it wasn't so much before, but now I feel a little bit suspicious of the notion that parenting is a spiritual practice. And the reason I'm a little bit suspicious is that I'm suspicious in the sense that that my relationship with my son is supposed to be for the purpose of my spiritual growth. It's, you know, supposed to be some other purpose besides just being a parent and having a kid and being there for that. That should be enough to make it into some kind of something. It's like the student at Stanford. I did a meditation class at Stanford for a while. And this student came and said that we were talking about, I guess, spiritual experiences, and he was talking about how when he's intimate with a woman, that he feels that this great union with cosmic consciousness. And I asked him, well, that's very nice, but how does she feel about that? And it was as if, the way he was talking about it, was that as if this wonderful intimate relationship with this woman was serving a purpose beyond just the intimate relationship with a woman. It had some great cosmic significance, that, and the woman was maybe the tool or the vehicle for this great thing. And we were experts often, I think many of us, of using, either avoiding experience, avoiding life, avoiding birth and death, avoiding our suffering and sometimes avoiding our joys. And we're experts at using it for other purposes besides just the purpose of it being here in and of itself. First time I went to Thailand, I visited an American who'd recently been ordained as a Theravadan monk. And he'd been a monk for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And every day when he went out on his alms rounds with his teacher, the man who ordained him, they would go out and receive their food in their bowl, but someone would always give them a flower, like I think it was like a lotus flower. And he was instructed to receive the flower and to place it in the vase on his altar. And each day he put a new flower in the vase. And he was told specifically not to take any of the flower, ever take any of the flowers away. So I met them 2 or 3 weeks after this had begun, and you found the whole range of freshness in these flowers up on the altar, from the ones that he got today, which were very fresh and vibrant, to the ones he got 2 weeks ago, they were all wilted over and dead. And he explained to me that this was his teacher's way of trying to teach him about impermanence, that things change, and that you shouldn't overlook the fact that things are born and they pass away. So we're left with the feelings we have. We're left with, you know, kind of what I'm trying to say here is not to use life for any other purpose than just to live, to be alive. But what is that? Who knows? I don't know. I don't have a clue what it means to be alive. Right? We discover that as we live it, I suppose. But I'm very cognizant of how much we try to avoid life and how much we try to get away from it or change it or manipulate it. And it's possible to use Buddhist practice as just another technique, another way to avoid living your life as it happens to be right now. I know I've done that plenty of times. Just in meditation practice, a very simple example is when there's some kind of discomfort that I have, like it could be a knee pain or it could be some kind of emotional discomfort, I'll say, okay, I'm going to get concentrated. I think I'll get concentrated in my breath. And sometimes I can be successful and get concentrated in my breath, and I'm no longer aware of my knee or no longer aware of my sadness or whatever it might be there. And I just kind of, you know, and if it's really strong, my whatever I want to get away from, then I'll really blast my breath. It really just, you know, gets really focused. And that's an escape. It's kind of using a practice to get away from what's going on. Rather than using a practice, which is, I think, one of the main points of the practice, is not to get away from anything, but to let you get into it more fully, live it more fully, sense it more fully, live your life more fully, more intimately, and be in the midst of the world of life and death more fully, be in the midst of the world of being a parent more fully, being in the midst of someone dying, be there most fully. Rather than avoiding it or excusing it or resisting it. And one of the things I'm aware of is that in saying something like this, that the point of practice is to live your life fully as it is, that's for sometimes that's a very bad news, and because our life often is very unpleasant. There's a lot of suffering and a lot of pain that a lot of us experience, and a lot of us would like to find some way, some relief to the kind of suffering and pain that we have. And traditionally, Buddhism is offered as a salve, as a solution, as a relief to suffering. The first and second noble and third noble truth is a relief to suffering. And how does this work to what I'm saying? And the way I understand it is that a lot of the unnecessary suffering we have in our life is our resistance and our fears and our avoidance of life as it's lived through us, as it occurs, life and death as it happens for us. And that the teaching to kind of allow ourselves fully to feel and experience what's happening right now is offering the relief from all the kinds of ways, all the sufferings, all the pains that involve resisting and holding on and manipulating because we don't want to face what's going on right now. I think that if we study our lives, what we find is that a lot of our suffering that we feel comes from some kind of subtle or gross form of non-acceptance. I'm not going to accept this particular experience right now. And that adds a kind of suffering, kind of. And if we learn to accept or learn to open up fully to this particular experience of birth and death that's happening right now, then that level of resistance is not there, and that kind of suffering is not present. And you might be left with a different kind of suffering, the suffering that's inherent in life, the suffering of grief when someone dies. I don't think anybody's supposed to take that away from us. Or we're left with a joy, you know, and someone hits a first base out there. You know, it's pretty neat to watch his kids run and make first base, except for unless you're the first baseman. There's all this joy and sorrow that's part of life if we can live it. But so the question I'm coming into this talk with is, what do we use our Buddhist practice for? What do we use our mindfulness practice for? Do we use it as a way of avoidance? Do we use it as a way to get something that's not already here? Or do we use it as a way of arriving here more fully, getting here more fully, just being here more fully with what's here? And that's the whole range of what that might be in any given day or given hour. I'm reminded of the Zen story of this very diligent Zen monk who would always be sitting Zazen, always be sitting in Zen meditation. And whenever he had a free moment, he'd go and sit in the meditation hall and sit meditation. And everybody else was out doing walking meditation, and he'd be in there, you know, doing his meditation. And so one day his teacher came up to him and picked up a piece of tile that was on the ground and started polishing the tile. And he was sitting there in meditation, you know, trying to just follow his breath or whatever he was doing. And his teacher was sitting next to him, just kind of taking a cloth and just polishing the tile. And after a while, the person in meditation kind of noticed this was kind of odd behavior of the teacher, and finally broke his meditation and asked, you know, what are you doing? the teacher asked him in return, what are you doing? And the student said, oh, I'm making a Buddha. I'm trying to become a Buddha. The story goes a little bit this way. The teacher says, the student asks, what are you doing polishing the tile? And the teacher says, I'm trying to make a mirror. I'm making a mirror. And the student says, that's silly. You can't make a mirror by polishing a tile enough. You can get it shiny, but it won't become a mirror. And the teacher says, yes, in the same way, you can't become a Buddha by getting yourself concentrated in meditation. You can't make yourself into a Buddha by sitting a lot, by forcing yourself to sit a lot and have some kind of great change or movement or whatever, opening, something like that. And this is a famous story in Zen, the story of polishing the tile, trying to make a mirror out of the tile. And the story for me is a story of trying to use the practice again to try to become something different than what you are. As if becoming a Buddha is something that you attain when you get X amount of concentration or X amount of insight or X amount of peace or calm or tranquility. But rather, as this teaching goes sometimes, is you're already a Buddha. Which in traditional Buddhism is a blasphemous thing to say. But the teaching is that you're already a Buddha, meaning that there's something about this life that we live it as we live it. Something about being a human being with in the midst of birth and death that is complete and full enough in itself, but we don't have to make ourselves into something else in order to be adequate, in order to be worthy, in order to be, you know, just to be an okay person. So how does mindfulness practice tie into all this? Well, again, as I keep saying, mindfulness practice is to help us wake up most fully to what's already here. And in that waking up to who we are right now, that itself is liberation or the freedom. But what we need to do is we need to be really careful that we are sensitive to what's going on right now and not to kind of be partial or to be kind of be selective and say, oh, I'm only going to pay attention to this part of my life and not that part of my life. I'm a Buddha, yes, and the only thing the Buddhas pay attention to is the breath. So I'm going to pay attention to my breath, and I'm not going to pay attention to the fact that I'm angry. You know, as if that's, and you're only a part Buddha. To wake up in mindfulness is to wake up to the full domain, the full range of everything that's going on for us. And that honest, trying to find that complete honesty is how we arrive right here and who we are right now. When I'll tell you, maybe some of you have heard this story before. What I call somewhat like three phases of my practice life. The first phase was actually before I started practicing meditation. And this is when I was sailing across the Atlantic in a sailboat when I think I was 19 or 20, 19. And a small sailboat, and we didn't have any what they have now of the what's called auto helm, automatic. You don't have to be at the helm anymore. You just attach special device to your rudder or the boat, and it kind of boat follows, guides itself through the ocean, and you just kind of sit there and read your book. It makes for kind of different kind of sailing. So we had to be at the helm, and there were four of us, so it meant 6 hours a day we had to be at the helm, and we had 2-hour shifts, and I would have one shift, I think, in the middle of the night from 2 to 4. So it was a beautiful time of day or night to be there in the middle of the Atlantic, and you've never seen so many stars as you do in the middle of an ocean, and all this ocean, and it was quite something to be out in the middle of the ocean, because you know you're so far away from anything. If you fall in. So at middle of the night, 2:30 in the morning, I had to pee, and I'm the only one on deck. Everyone else is sleeping. You better believe I held on tight. I'd hold on to the railing really tight as I'd pee over the railing into the ocean, because if I fell in, no one would know, and it'd be. So it was beautiful to be out there. And one of the things I decided, at the beginning of that trip, was that it was okay to have a fantasy life. Until that time, I kind of thought maybe it was something funny or wrong about fantasizing, because as you probably know, I hope you know, is that human beings can have all kinds of bizarre fantasies. And the more bizarre they are, the more I felt that they had to be censored. So I decided that it was fine to have a fantasy life, just to fantasize whatever way I wanted. That fantasy in and of itself wasn't a problem. So I had these wonderful opportunities, out there in the middle of the ocean, no one around, everybody sleeping in the middle of the night. It was a great time to, kind of engage and let my mind kind of wander. But the beautiful thing about the sailing was that every couple of seconds, I had to look at the compass, I had to look at the sails, I had to adjust the course a little bit. I had to kind of make a small course adjustment. So I gave this kind of this complete freedom to my mind to do whatever it wanted. And then every second or two, I had to kind of ground myself in reality, what was happening in the present moment, by just, because of the task at hand, sailing the boat. And it was this combination of coming back to the present moment without any coercion or force or any feeling that I was supposed to, because it was a practice, it was just, the job. And then giving my mind this freedom. And at least these two things weren't in conflict. It wasn't like one wasn't conflicting with the other. I didn't have any idea of that. It was just, I was doing both things. I was giving the freedom to my mind and just coming back to the present moment, moment after moment. At the end of that trip, when we got across the Atlantic, I was more ecstatic, felt more peace and joy than I'd ever had in my life before that. And I attributed that a lot to this practice of giving freedom to my mind and coming back to the present moment with my hand on the helm. So when I came, the next phase of my practice is when I was introduced to Zen. And I would start sitting Zazen, and the main instruction I was given was to pay attention to the posture and pay attention to my breath. And I said, maybe it's just like being on a boat. And I'll do the same thing. I'll give freedom to my mind to do whatever it wants, freedom to my heart to do whatever it feels, and not really pay attention to it, but just let it do whatever it wants. And I'm just going to come back whenever I can, as much as I can, every few seconds or whatever, come back to my breathing and ground myself in the present moment by being connected to the breath. And it was, a wonderful practice for me, and I felt very lucky to have had this lesson from sailing, because then I gave myself this permission in my Zen meditation to not censor or not criticize or not judge or not think it was wrong to have a mind that does what a mind to do, just that wandered away and fantasized and thought or whatever, or have feelings or whatever. I didn't try to interrupt it or resist it, but I also didn't try to indulge in it. I just tried regularly to come back to my breathing and be with the breath and be with the breath. And it worked very well for me. I was very happy doing that Zen practice that way. And then I was introduced to Vipassana practice. And Vipassana practice added a refinement to this for me. And the refinement was, I learned that I didn't have to turn away from anything to find my grounding in the present moment. In Zen, I found my grounding in the present moment in the breath or in my posture. What I learned in Vipassana was that you can do that with anything. You can do that with anything that arose in your experience. You can find that grounding in the present moment. You can wake up to the present moment and find that reality check. So, if there was a strong feeling arose, emotional feeling that arose, I didn't have to turn away from that emotional feeling to the breath to find myself back in the present moment, to find that myself in the reality. I could actually wake up to being angry, because anger was happening in the present moment just as much as anything else, just as much as the breath. And so I would say, oh, anger, I recognize the anger. And I would open to the experience of anger as a present experience. Not as something to kind of indulge in or get caught up in or get more angry or get involved in the story of the anger, but rather, oh, in the present moment there's this event of anger. Just like in the present moment there's the experience of inhalation. And seeing the anger that way and grounding it as an event in the present moment, I would find that I could have that reality check. I could find myself waking up just as well as I could with the breath. If I started fantasizing my thoughts, I didn't have to turn away from thinking to find this, myself in the present moment. I could acknowledge or see or recognize that thinking was happening in the present moment. The beautiful thing about thinking is if you're thinking about the past or thinking about the future, both those kinds of thinkings are happening in the present moment. So if you're going to be here now, you don't have to turn away from past thinking and future thinking. What you have to do is to see it, that it's happening and unfolding in the present moment. And you don't have to indulge in it, but you see it for what it is. So again, we can give this freedom to ourselves, freedom to whatever's going on, and then we can learn how to meet that and see that as the place we wake up or ground ourselves in the present moment, so we don't get lost and carried away. I'm convinced that if I had not been at the helm, at the boat, when I was sailing across the Atlantic, but rather had spent all that time just fantasizing, just complete freedom to my fantasy in whatever way I wanted to, I might have ended up in an insane asylum by the time I got across the ocean. Thank God we have reality. Helping us out all the time. Most of us, reality bumps into us all the time. So it keeps us, most of us, from kind of going off too far. But what I think what practice can do is to help us meet reality more often rather than just wait until it bumps into us. And we do that by cultivating the ability to recognize and see what is happening now in the present moment without ever having to turn away from anything. You don't have to turn towards anything or away from anything at all. Something happens. Something's always happening. And when something's happening, can you meet that and see it directly with this non-discursive awareness that doesn't analyze or figure out or judge, just sees it or feels it or recognizes it. This is what's going on in the present moment. And then something else will happen, and then something else will happen. Something's always happening. You don't have to go look for anything when you do meditation practice, mindfulness. You don't have to try to make something happen. You don't have to say that this is the wrong thing, this is not what's supposed to be happening. If it's happening, it's supposed to be happening. That's the way it goes. If this is what's going on, then this is what's supposed to be going on. And then we bring our attention to that. So we don't try to polish the mirror, but rather we try just to make each moment experience the mirror. Each moment experience is the mirror of what mindfulness and awareness reflects. I was also motivated today to tell you, maybe since I had one Zen story, to tell you another, if I may. And this is a story from the Zen Master Dogen's visit to China. As a young man, he went to China to try to answer his great question, spiritual quest. And he was gung-ho about meditation. He was going to the great China, which China was the place where he felt like Japan, there was no answers to his spiritual questions in Japan. Buddhism in Japan was kind of young, and he was going to go to China, the source of Japanese Buddhism, much of it. And he was pretty gung-ho, he was ready to go meditate in Zen monasteries. And he finally made it across the ocean to China. And it turned out that he had the wrong kind of paperwork to enter into China. Because, you know, China was a great bureaucracy, and you have to have the right papers. So, in the year 1227, he had the wrong papers. So he had to stay on board the boat for 3 months, waiting to get the paperwork sorted out. I think he wrote a petition to the Emperor of China. And during that time on the boat, the head cook of a monastery, a Zen monastery, came to the boat. And to try to buy some mushrooms from the Japanese to use for the meal the next day in the monastery. And this monk had been a monk for 40 years. He was 61 years old. He was the head monk of a monastery, head cook of a monastery. And he had traveled a long distance, maybe all afternoon, to get to where the ship was to ask to buy some mushrooms to make a little nicer meal the next day. And Dogen was kind of very delighted to be able to meet the Zen monk. He'd come to China for this purpose, and an elder one who'd been practicing for 40 years nonetheless, and was eager to have the monk stay. And he said, well, you're a senior monk. You've been practicing for 40 years. Why don't you stay behind and spend the night here? And we'll have wonderful discussions. And the monk declined, saying he was afraid that the normal procedures of the monastery the next morning, in terms of making the meals, would be interrupted if he wasn't there. And he felt a responsibility to take care of things. And then Dogen asked, well, isn't there someone else who could make the meal for you? And instead of making all, you know, you've been a monk for 40 years, you're very senior. Why are you cooking? Shouldn't you be spending your time in meditation? Isn't it much more valuable to be meditating? You know, I don't understand, you know. And the monk just looks at Dogen and says, you're the one who doesn't understand. You don't understand the true nature of negotiating the way. You don't understand what it is to practice wakefulness. To see the path in everything that you do. And this stunned Dogen, because Dogen thought the place where he was going to practice, the only place that practice really counted, was in meditation. So then, eventually Dogen got his paperwork in order, and he went into China to the monasteries, and he went to another monastery where there was another elderly head cook. This one was 68 years old. And the story he tells was this guy was so old that and kind of weak that he walked around with a staff. And he was in the courtyard in front of the temple cooking, in the courtyard, drying mushrooms. And it was a scorchingly hot afternoon. And the old monk was kind of struggling with his staff and kind of moving the mushrooms around, placing them out. And he was drenched in sweat. And Dogen was kind of amazed. He said, why are you doing this? You're a most senior monk. You've been a monk for many years. Why aren't you meditating? And he got kind of the same answer. You know, you don't quite understand what the path is all about. And he said, well, there's a lot of these lay helpers, assistants in the monasteries. Can't you get them to do it for you? And he said, to get it right, I'll read it. Said, oh, others are not I. So that's an interesting answer. Why don't you get other people to do it for you, do the work? Others are not I. Then Dogen says, "But it's so hot. Why do you have to do the work now?" And the cook says, "If not now, when can I do it?" And this simple answer, these simple answers, again, stun Dogen, this great Japanese Zen monk. If not now, then when do I do it? And I like this a lot, this answer. If not now, when do I do it? If I don't take care of my life now, if I don't meet my life as it is now, whether it's in meditation or whether it's cooking or whether it's cleaning or whatever, then when are you going to meet your life? You know, are you going to meet your life tomorrow? Today's not a particularly good day to meet my life because, after all, it's kind of windy. It's not a good day for it. You know, let's wait. Let's put it off. You know, we'll just, you know. Or I have a headache today, so I don't have to meet my life today. If not now, then when? Is the question. And then others are not I. Can you expect someone else to do it for you? Can someone else do it? Can someone else kind of do this practice for you so you don't have to do it? And that's patently absurd. You have to do it for yourself. Sometimes there's an expectation that a teacher will somehow give you the answer that will make it all work, or make you work, or make you release you, or something. I don't think it really usually happens that way. And if it does happen sometimes that way, I don't know if it's a good policy, because then you kind of depend on someone else for what you have to do for yourself. So I started the day by talking about allowing as being a theme for practice, a possible theme, allowing things to be as they are. And then I mentioned, I think before lunch, about kind of a healthy sense of allowing and kind of unhealthy way of allowing things to be. It isn't that we're supposed to stop sitting in meditation because meditation is not going to make you a Buddha. It isn't that we're supposed to kind of just go to the beach. I think it's necessary, if we're really going to be honest about ourselves and honest about the ways in which we get caught up in our busyness and caught up in our preoccupations and get lost in our fears, or really honest about what really motivates and drives our life, I think we'll really realize how useful it is to find some kind of practice which helps us to slow down enough or to stop enough so we can really see clearly what's happening in the present moment. If we simply allow ourselves to continue doing whatever we're doing anyway, then for many of us, we just perpetuate the suffering, perpetuate the unhealthy ways in which we engage in our life. And so a day like today is a day, I think it's quite powerful, to come and, in a very simple way, slow down or even to stop, perhaps, all the incessant movements and activities and momentum that we have. And then in the slowing down, beginning to notice more carefully what's actually here for you. And then when you start noticing what's actually here for you in the present moment, then you need to remember that you're not here to polish the mirror. You're here to be the mirror. You're here actually to allow and feel and sense honestly what is actually here, regardless of what it is. And I have no idea, no agenda of what each of you are supposed to be experiencing on a day like today. Each of you will have a completely different kind of experience while you're here. And it'll always be that way. And I think that's part of the beauty of it. Each of you has your own experience. Each of you is your own individual with your experience and your history and your past, and you bring it here. And hopefully this is a place where it's conducive and supportive for all of us to become intimate with who we really are, to arrive here and be yourself, maybe in the kind of, to paraphrase T.S. Eliot, to arrive here and be yourself that you always were. And if you arrive here, you arrive into the world of birth and death. a woman dies in the morning and a child is born in the afternoon. And so it goes. So that's about all that occurs to me to say today. Does it occur to any of you to say anything?
For if you become too good at meditation, you may lose yourself. And then silence. And that's beginning meditation. I've been rolling that around. Would you elaborate?
I will. And I'm not to dismiss your question, but was it useful that was said for you?
It was jarring, and in that regard, it was useful. It brought me very present for the rest of the day. and I came with a commitment to be really present today anyway. I guess the first question that came up for me then is, then if that's the case, then what's the teaching of anatta, of no self?
So excuse me, what's the connection then between...
Right.
What's the connection between my statement and anatta?
And anatta, as I'm trying to understand.
No self.
Right.
So you're interested in the connection between the teaching of no self and my statement that...
Well, that's one question that occurs to me, and actually, I'm probably more interested in what you really intended as when you said it.
Uh-huh. I'll try to say what I intended, and but I'm actually find myself much more interested in what happens within you, and I think where wisdom will happen, where teaching will happen, is your response to that statement. And if you got jarred, the place where you were jarred, I think, is a very interesting place. And if I give you an answer, it might actually veer you away from really the place you're supposed to be paying attention, where it's useful to pay attention. So, but I'll give you an answer anyway. So those of you maybe weren't here or didn't hear, I said something like, I don't remember exactly what I said, but I said something like, it's not so useful to become really good at meditation. Or it's important not to become too good at meditation, because then you might lose yourself. Is that close enough to what I said? And so I said that because it can kind of be like the monk polishing the tile, right? You can get really good at getting concentrated. You can get really good at developing certain psychological tools of the mind, so you can kind of actually avoid the present moment rather than really wake up to the present moment. Depends, you know, how we define meditation. So, if we define meditation as simply being present, then maybe you can never be present enough. I mean, so you never, you know, to warn you from being too good at that is not so useful. But to the degree in which many of us come to meditation practice with some idea we're supposed to attain something, we're supposed to get. If I get so far with meditation, then I'll do it right. If you have some idea of where you're supposed to go with it, that very idea will subtly or grossly take you away from where you are right now. And the path of the practice is simply to wake up where you are right now and then see what unfolds as you do that. That was part of the intention of saying it. And the other part is, some of us are quite concerned about being successful or doing things right. And we bring that to meditation practice. And I'm going to do it right, and I can't do it right. I'm not doing good enough, and I'm not staying with my breath long enough, and everybody else is already halfway to Buddhahood, and here I am still, you know, struggling or whatever we think. And we have all these judgment expectations and measurements we use on ourselves about what meditation and good meditation is. And it really interferes a lot. And so if we drop the idea that we have to be a good meditator, don't even try to be a good meditator, then it's a lot easier to relax. And if you relax, it's a lot easier to be a good meditator. Something like that. But remember, my answer is not as important as what happened to you when I said it. My intention is not as... It's better sometimes to be left perplexed than to understand what the teacher said, what was meaning, and then feel, I understand now, okay. And then you go home.
Because I see how much I'm not present, so it goes around and around. You know, I mean, I really see how much my mind goes off.
And with great respect, why should that be a cause of discouragement?
Well, I guess I see my intention is to be present with what is, and I see that that's not, well, I suppose if I see that I've gone off, I'm seeing where I am, right?
That, you got it.
All right.
So there's a very bizarre thing about this practice, is that if you have enough wherewithal to recognize that you haven't been present very much, you have enough wherewithal to do the practice, to be present. If you can recognize, oh, I haven't been present, that's a recognition of what's happening. And at that point, you can either say, well, shit, I blew it, you know, I wasn't so present. That's extra, you added something extra on top of it. You can just, it's enough, just, oh, I wasn't present, but now I am present. You can leave it really simple. And it might be that if you leave it simple, you're much less likely to wander off again. But if we react, if we kind of notice we were drifted off, and we measure it and measure ourselves against that and react and criticize it and all that, we just add to the way in which we spin ourselves up in a tight ball. So, and if it's a tendency you do anyway, you want to try to use meditation as some way that breaks that tendency. So you have a different attitude towards meditation, different than everything else you do in your life. So maybe this is a small key, is when you find yourself drifting off, rather than being upset that you have drift off, celebrate that now you're present for that moment. And that, mindfulness is very bizarre also, because you can't do it wrong. And maybe this is not consoling to anyone, but I kind of find it tickling that this is, you can't do it wrong. Because either you're not present enough to know that you're not present, in which case there's no problem, right? there's no problem if you're kind of completely lost in your thoughts or whatever. You're not present enough to know. As soon as you're present enough to know, you're present and you're doing the practice. So either you're doing it, or you're not doing it. But if you're not doing it, means that you don't know you're not doing it. So there's no problem. Does that make sense? So just relax. That's the whole point. All I'm trying to say is try to relax around the practice. Don't try too hard. But don't be too lax either. Don't be too relaxed about it either. There's this wonderful middle way of being engaged fully in being present, but not being tight or forceful about it, not sitting with expectation, and not being too relaxed either. Yes, Doris.
When you say to have mindfulness of breath being in the foreground, I find it very hard not to make it into a concentration. And then it becomes dualistic for me. I feel I have to pay attention to the breath, and then I notice I automatically repress other things. I can't prevent myself from, it seems, from repressing thoughts and feelings and so forth. And so I'm feeling like maybe that's, I should just have choiceless awareness.
Maybe so. So what you're pointing out is that each of us has our own particular way our minds work, and depending on all kinds of things. And so part of what we need to do with mindfulness is to recognize our tendencies and then kind of understand, you know, what's appropriate given that. For many people, the mind is so busy that just doing very simple breath meditation helps slow things down enough so you can start being honestly seeing what's going on. But some people, for various reasons, tend towards getting too concentrated. And you can get too concentrated for the purposes of mindfulness. And so then it might not be so useful to just stay in the breath. You might stay in the breath a little bit to get a little bit concentrated and then open up to choiceless awareness. So it's not either or, but use your ability to get concentrated to get a little bit settled. But before you get super settled, then you open up and sit with choiceless awareness. The word repression is a very strong word, so I just want to make sure you really mean that word, because repression means really intentionally not wanting to look at something.
Like you said earlier, whatever arises, and so if we're noticing the breath and not noticing other things, it seems contradictory to what you said about noticing whatever arises.
When you get the full instructions from mindfulness, the instructions is to sit basically in choiceless awareness, to sit with whatever arises and allow whatever arises and connect to that. However, even so, we give a little bit of priority to the breath. We try to emphasize being with the breath because it's very useful to develop some ability to stabilize the mind and to develop, get really familiar with one object, which is changing, a changing object. The breath is changing, it's rising and passing. But we don't do it as the be-all and end-all. We don't hold on to the breath really tightly. But we cultivate some concentration there. But as we sit, something else sooner or later will usually happen that takes precedent over the breath. If you sit long enough, maybe your knee hurts. If you sit long enough, maybe some other kind of feeling or sensation or emotion arises that becomes more predominant, more pronounced in the breath. And then the instruction is to leave the breath. But if your experience is, you've been doing this practice for some time now, if your experience is that you're almost never aware of other things in your life and you're always with your breath, then maybe you want to practice it more in choiceless awareness and don't bother with the breath, if that works for you. I've known plenty of people who spent many, many years just focusing on the breath and at the expense of not really learning about other parts of their life. And sometimes that's useful and sometimes it's not. Is that an appropriate enough answer to you?
It's not that I'm so concentrated, I think I'm just kind of rigid. You know, my mind has to be kind of...
Rigid.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So you're rigid. What you might do is experiment with continuing with the breath and seeing if the fluidity, the fluxing sensation, the change that's inherent in breathing can help loosen whatever place you feel the rigidity. so that the breath actually begins lubricating and massaging the rigidity. That's one of the beauty, one of the beauties about the breath is the breath is so impermanent, so much in flux. And you might feel, maybe if you feel the rigidity in your chest or in your torso somewhere, then use the breath to breathe into those places of holding and see if you can begin cultivating the flux, the fluidity of breath. And as the more fluid the breath is, the less rigid the mind will be. It's one of the great reasons why breath meditation is so great. It's very hard to be fixated if you're paying attention and if you allow the breath to be free. What you might notice is that when you get uptight, all of us, when we get uptight, that often the breath kind of gets held also. But if you pay attention to your breath and breathe consciously and let the breath kind of breathe more fully again, more naturally again, then it's very hard to stay uptight. So it's great. The breath is great. So I like following my breath a lot. It helps kind of lubricate my day. Yes.
I noticed for myself it was hard to stay present with the exhalation.
Yes.
It's almost like the inhalation is pleasurable, or be with that, but I would lose it watching it go down.
A lot can be said about that, but again, this is a situation where it's more valuable for you to study that, find out what's to be learned there, rather than me giving some kind of generic answer. The main reason I said that this morning is that, if part of the cycle of breathing is less clear than anything else, then the mind, in a sense, is idle. It's not engaged, or something. And it's that idle moment where the things are not so clear, where the mind most likely will wander off into thought. And so if we simply know that tendency, and then just kind of very gently, without any force, just kind of remind ourselves, stay present for that part where the breath is kind of vague. It's easier to stay present through time. Different people, it varies what part of the breath is vague, but probably the most common place is the end of the exhalation, because it gets kind of subtle for most people. And in addition, exhalation is kind of a letting go. And some people, quite a few people, have trouble letting go. They're afraid of letting go. And some people will find that if they really resist being present for the letting go part of the exhalation, sometimes you'll find underneath there is, if there's real resistance, more than just being kind of vague about it, you'll find there's a kind of fear that underlies that moment. And then connecting and being honest about that fear can really help us be more present. Anything else for today? So I'll mention again that about the Dana baskets there, partly because